right eventually, but God knew it wasn't going to be a jolly family evening. Well as I knew Jamie, there were still a good many circumstances in which I had no idea how he would react, and hearing that his daughter was pregnant by a rapist was certainly one of them. In the hours since Brianna had made my suspicions a certainty, I had envisioned virtually every possible response he might make, several of them involving shouting or the putting of his fists through solid objects, behaviour which I always found upsetting. So might Bree, and I knew rather better what she might do when upset. She was under a tight control for the moment, but I knew how precarious her calm demeanour was. Let him say a bruising word to her, and she would flare like a striking match. Beyond red hair and arresting height, she had from Jamie both a passionate nature and a perfect readiness to speak her mind. So unfamiliar and so anxious to please each other, they had both so far stepped delicately. But there seemed no delicate way of handling this. Unsure whether I should prepare myself to be advocate, interpreter, or referee, it was with rather a hollow feeling that I lifted the latch to let him in. He had washed at the creek. His hair was damp at the temples, and he had wiped his face on his shirt tail, judging by the moist patches on it.
"You're very late. Where were you?"
I asked, standing on tiptoe to give him a kiss.
"And where's Ian?"
"Fergus came and asked could we give him a hand wi' his chimney stones, as he couldn't manage very well by himself. Ian stayed over to help him finish the job."
He dropped an absent kiss on top of my head and patted my bottom. He'd been working hard, I thought. He was warm to my touch and smelled pungently of sweat, though the skin of his face was cool and fresh from washing.
"Did Masali feed you supper?"
I peered at him in the gloom. Something seemed different about him, though I couldn't think what.
"No, I've dropped a stone and I've maybe broken my blasted finger again. I thought I'd best come home and have you tend to it."
That was it, I thought. He'd patted me with his left hand instead of his right.
"Come into the light and let me see."
I drew him to the fire and made him sit down on one of the oak settles. Brianna was on the other, her sewing spread around her. She got up and came to look over my shoulder.
"Your poor hands, Dar," she said,
seeing the swollen knuckles and scraped skin.
"Oh, it's no great matter,"
he said, glancing dismissively at them.
"Save for the bloody finger. Ow!"
I felt my way gently over the fourth finger of his right hand, from base to nail, disregarding his small grunt of pain. It was reddened and slightly swollen, but not visibly dislocated. It always troubled me slightly to examine this hand. I had set a number of broken bones in it long ago, before I knew anything of formal surgery, and working under far from ideal conditions. I had managed. I had saved the hand from amputation, and he had good use of it. But there were small awkwardnesses, slight twistings and thickenings that I was aware of whenever I felt it closely. Still, at the moment, I blessed the opportunity for delay. I closed my eyes, feeling the fire's warm flicker on my lids as I concentrated. The fourth finger was always stiff. The middle joint had been crushed and healed frozen. I could see the bone in my mind, not the polished dry surface of a laboratory specimen, but the faintly luminous matte glow of living bone, all the tiny osteoblasts busily laying down their crystal matrix, and the hidden pulse of the blood that fed them. Once more I drew my own finger down the length of his, then took it gently between my thumb and index finger, just below the distal joint. I could feel the crack in my mind, a thin dark line of pain. "There?" I asked, opening my eyes. He nodded, a faint smile on his lips as he looked at me.
"Just there. I like the way you look when you do that, Sasana."
"What way is that?" I asked, a bit startled to hear that I looked any way in particular.
"I kinda describe it exactly," he said,
head tilted to one side as he examined me.
"It's maybe like..."
"Madame Lazonga with her crystal ball,"
Brianna said, sounding amused. I glanced up, taken aback, to find Brianna gazing down at me, head cocked at the same angle, with the same appraising look. She switched her gaze to Jamie.
A fortune-teller, I mean. A seer.
He laughed. Aye, I think you're maybe right, Ian. Though it was a priest I was thinking of. The way they look saying Mass, when they look past the bread and see the flesh of Christ instead. Not that I should think to compare my measly finger with the body of our Lord, mind, he added, with a modest nod toward the offending digit.
Brianna laughed, and a smile curved his mouth on one side as he looked up at her, his eyes soft despite the lines of tiredness round them. He'd had a long day, I thought, and likely to be a lot longer. I would have given anything to hold that fleeting moment of connection between them, but it had passed already.
I think you're both ridiculous, I said.
I touched his finger lightly at the spot I'd held. The bone is cracked, just there below the joint. It's not bad, though. No more than a hairline fracture. I'll splint it just in case. I got up and went to rummage through my medical chest for a linen bandage and one of the long, flat wood chips I use as tongue depressors. I glanced covertly over the raised lid, watching him. Something was definitely odd about him this evening, though I still couldn't put my finger on it. I had sensed it from the first, even through my own agitation, and sensed it even more strongly when I held his hand to examine it. A sort of energy pulsed through him, as though he were excited or upset, though he gave no outward sign of it. He was bloody good at hiding things when he wanted to. What the hell had happened at Fergus's house? Brianna said something to Jamie, too low for me to catch, then turned away without waiting for an answer, and came to join me by the open chest.
"Do you have some ointment for his hands?" she asked.
Then, leaning close on pretext of looking into the chest, said in a low voice,
"Should I tell him tonight? He's tired and he's hurt. Hadn't I better let him rest?"
I glanced at Jamie. He was leaning back against the settle, eyes wide open as he watched the flames, hands resting flat on his thighs. He wasn't relaxed, though. Whatever strange current was flowing through him, it had him strung like a telegraph wire.
"He might rest better, not knowing, but you won't," I said, equally low-voiced.
"Go ahead and tell him. You might let him eat first, though," I added practically. I was a strong believer in meeting bad news on a full stomach. I splinted Jamie's finger while Brianna sat down beside him and dabbed gentian ointment onto the abraded knuckles of his other hand. Her face was quite calm. No one would ever guess what was going on behind it.
"You've torn your shirt," I said,
finishing off the last bandage with a small square knot. "Give it to me after supper, and I'll mend it." "How's that, then?"
"Very nice, Madame Lozonga," he said, gingerly wriggling his freshly splinted finger. "I shall be getting quite spoilt with so much attention paid me."
"When I start to chew your food for you, you can worry," I said tartly. He laughed, and gave the splinted hand to Bree for anointing. I went to the cupboard to fetch a plate for him. As I turned back toward the hearth, I saw him watching her intently. She kept her head bent, eyes on the large, calloused hand she held between her own. I could imagine her search for words with which to begin, and my heart ached for her. Perhaps I should have told him privately myself, I thought, not let him near her until the first rush of feeling was safely past, and he had himself in hand again.
"Kemarahau, Mochia,"
he said suddenly. It was his customary greeting to her, the beginning of their evening Gaelic lesson. But his voice was different tonight, soft and very gentle.
"How are you, darling?"
His hand turned and covered hers, cradling her long fingers.
"Hamigaha, ache," she replied,
looking a bit surprised.
"I'm well, father."
Normally he began the lesson after dinner. Slowly he reached out with his other hand and rested it gently on her stomach.
"Anya nivna haga," he asked.
"Do you tell me true?"
I closed my eyes and let out a breath I didn't realize I'd been holding. No need to break all the news after all. And now I knew the reason for his taut-strung strangeness. He knew, and whatever the knowledge cost him to hold it he would, and treat her gently. She didn't know enough Gaelic yet to tell what he'd asked, but she knew well enough what he meant. She stared at him for a moment, frozen, then lifted his sound hand to her cheek and bent her head over it, the loose hair hiding her face. "Oh, da," she said, very quietly. "I'm sorry." She sat quite still, holding to his hand as though it were a lifeline.
"Ah, no, Mountsach," he said softly. "It will be all right."
"No, it won't," she said, her voice small but clear. "It can't ever be right. You know that." He glanced at me out of habit, but only briefly. I couldn't tell him what to do now. He drew a deep breath, took her by the shoulder, and gave her a gentle shake.
"All I know," he said softly, "is that I'm here by you, and your mother too. We will na see you shamed or hurt, not ever. Do you hear me?"
She didn't answer or look up, but kept her eyes on her lap, her face hidden by the rich fall of her hair. A maiden's hair, thick and unbound. His hand traced the shining curve of her head, then his fingers trailed along her jaw and lifted her chin so her eyes looked into his.
"Lizzie's right," he asked gently. "It was rape."
She pulled her chin away and looked down at her knotted hands, the gesture as much an admission as her nod. "I didn't think she knew. I didn't tell her."
"She guessed, but it's no your fault, and dinna ever think so," he said firmly. "Come here to me, Alanna."
He reached for her and gathered her awkwardly onto his knee. The oak wood creaked alarmingly under their combined weight, but Jamie had built it after his usual sturdy fashion. It could have held six of him. Tall as Brianna was, she looked almost small, cradled in his arms, her head tucked into the curve of his shoulder. He stroked her hair gently and murmured small things to her, half in Gaelic.
"I'll see you safe married, and you'll bairn wi' a good father," he murmured to her. "I swear it to you, Aneen."
"I can't marry anybody," she said, sounding choked. "It wouldn't be right. I can't take somebody else when I love Roger. And Roger won't want me now. When he finds out..."
"It'll make no difference to him,"
Jamie said, grasping her harder, almost fiercely, as though he could make things right by pure force of will.
"If he's a decent man, it'll make no difference. And if it does, well, then he doesna deserve you, and I shall beat him into pulp and stamp on the pieces, and then go and find you a better man."
She gave a small laugh that turned into a sob and buried her head in the cloth of his shoulder. He patted her, rocking and murmuring as though she were a tiny girl with a skinned knee, and his eyes met mine over her head. I hadn't wept when she had told me. Mothers are strong. But now she couldn't see me, and Jamie had taken the burden of strength from my shoulders for the moment. She hadn't cried when she told me either, but now she clung to him and wept as much from relief, I thought, as from grief. He simply held her and let her cry, stroking her hair again and again, his eyes on my face. I blotted my eyes on my sleeve, and he smiled at me faintly. Brianna had subsided into long, sighing breaths, and he patted her gently on the back.
"I'm hungry, Sassenach," he said, "and I should imagine a wee drop wouldn't have come amiss for any of us, aye."
"Right," I said, and cleared my throat. "I'll go and fetch some milk from the shed."
"That's no what I meant by drink,"
he called after me in mock outrage. Ignoring both this and Brianna's choked laugh, I pushed open the door. The night outside was cold and bright, the autumn stars bright sparks overhead. I wasn't dressed to be outdoors. My face and hands were already beginning to tingle, but I stood quite still nonetheless, letting the cold wind sweep past me, taking with it the tensions of the last quarter hour. Everything was quiet. The crickets and cicadas had long since died or gone underground with the rustling mice. The skunks and possums, who left off their endless search for food and went to dream their winter dreams, the rich fat of their efforts wrapped warm about their bones. Only wolves hunted in the cold, starry nights of late autumn, and they went silent fur-footed on the frozen ground. "What are we going to do?" I said softly, addressing the question to the overwhelming depths of the vast dark sky overhead. I heard no sound but the rush of wind in the pine trees, no answer save the form of my own question, the faint echo of "we" that rang in my ears. That much was true, at least. Whatever happened, none of us need face things alone. And I suppose that was, after all, as much answer as I needed for now. They were still on the settle when I came back in, red heads close together, haloed by the fire. The smell of gentian ointment mingled with the pungent scent of burning pine and the mouth-watering aroma of the venison stew. And quite suddenly, I was hungry. I let the door close quietly behind me and slid to the heavy bolt. I went to poke the fire and lay a new supper, fetching down a fresh loaf of bread from the shelf, then went to get sweet butter from the crock in the pantry. I stayed a moment there, glancing over the loaded shelves.
"Put your trust in God and pray for guidance, and when in doubt, eat."
The Franciscan monk had once given me that advice, and on the whole, I had found it useful. I picked out a jar of blackcurrant jam, a small round goat cheese, and a bottle of elderflower wine to go with the meal. Jamie was talking quietly when I came back. I finished my preparations, letting the deep lilt of his voice soothe me as well as Brianna.
"I used to think of you when you were small," Jamie was saying to Bree, his voice very soft. "When I lived in the Keeve, I would imagine that I held you in my arms, a wee babe. I would hold you so against my heart and sing to you there, watching the stars go by overhead."
"What would you sing?"
Brianna's voice was low, too, barely audible above the crackle of the fire. I could see her hand resting on his shoulder. Her index finger touched a long, bright strand of his hair, tentatively stroking its softness.
"Old songs. Lullabies I could remember that my mother sang to me. The same that my sister Ginny would sing to her bairns."
She sighed, a long, slow sound. "Sing to me now, please, da." He hesitated, but then tilted his head toward hers and began to chant softly, an odd, tuneless song in Gaelic. Jamie was tone-deaf. The song wavered oddly up and down, bearing no resemblance to music, but the rhythm of the words was a comfort to the ear. I caught most of the words, a fish's song, naming the fish of loch and sea, telling the child what he would bring home to her for food, a hunter's song, naming birds and beasts of prey, feathers for beauty and furs for warmth, meat to last the winter. It was a father's song, a soft litany of providence and protection. I moved quietly round the room, taking down the pewter plates and wooden bowls for supper, coming back to cut bread and spread it with butter.
"Do you know something, da?" Bree asked softly.
"What's that?" he said, momentarily suspending his song.
"You can't sing."
There was a soft exhalation of laughter and the rustle of cloth as he shifted to make them both more comfortable.
"Aye. Oh, that's true. Shall I stop, then?"
"No."
She snuggled closer, tucking her head into the curve of his shoulder. He resumed his tuneless crooning, only to interrupt himself a few moments later.
"Do you ken something yourself, Alanna?"
Her eyes were closed, her lashes casting deep shadows on her cheeks, but I saw her lips curve in a smile.
"What's that, da?"
"You weigh as much as a full-grown deer."
"Shall I get off, then?"
she asked, not moving.
"Of course not."
She reached up and touched his cheek.
"Magraigach ahet," she whispered. "My love to you, father."
He gathered her tightly against him, bent his head and kissed her forehead. The fire struck a knot of pitch and blazed up suddenly behind the settle, limning their faces in gold and black. His features were harsh cut and bold. Hers, a more delicate echo of his heavy, clean-edged bones. Both stubborn, both strong, and both, thank God, mine. Brianna fell asleep after supper, worn out from emotion. I was feeling rather limp myself, but not yet in any mood to sleep. I was at once exhausted and jittery, with that horrible battlefield feeling of being in the midst of events beyond my ability to control, but which must be dealt with anyway. I didn't want to deal with anything. What I wanted was to push away all thought of both present and future, and go back to the peace of the night before. I wanted to crawl into bed with Jamie, and lie warm against him, the two of us sealed safe beneath the quilts against the growing chill of the room, watching the embers fade as we talked softly, colloquy changing from the gossip and small jokes of the day to the language of the night. Let our talk go from words to touch, from breath to the small movements of the body that were in themselves question and answer. The completion of our conversation come at last to silence in the unity of sleep. But trouble lay on the house tonight, and there was no peace between us. He roamed the house like a caged wolf, picking things up and putting them down. I tidied away the things from dinner, watching him from the corners of my eyes. I wanted nothing more than to talk to him, and at the same time dreaded it. I had promised Bree not to tell him about Bonnet, but I was a bad enough liar at any time, and he knew my face so well. I filled a bucket of hot water from the big cauldron and took the pewter plates outside to rinse clean. I came back to find Jamie standing by the small shelf where he kept his inkhorn, quills, and paper. He hadn't undressed for bed, but he made no move to take them down and begin the usual evening's work. But, of course, he couldn't write with his damaged hand. "Do you want me to write something for you?" I asked, seeing him pick up a quill and put it down again. He turned away with a restless gesture. "No. I must write to Jenny, of course, and there are other things that must be done. I cannae bear to sit down and think just now."
"I know how you feel," I said sympathetically. He looked at me, a trifle startled.
"I cannae tell quite how I feel myself, Sassenach,"
he said with a queer laugh.
"If you think you know, tell me."
"Tired," I said, and laid a hand on his arm. "Angry. Worried." I glanced at Brianna, asleep in the trundle. "Heartbroken, maybe," I added softly.
"All of that," he said, "and a good bit more."
He wore no stock, but plucked at the collar of his shirt, as though it choked him.
"I cannae stay in here," he said.
He glanced at me. I was still dressed in my day clothes, skirt, shift, and bodice.
"Will you come out and walk with me a bit?"
I went at once to fetch my cloak. It was dark outside. He wouldn't be able to watch my face. We paced slowly together across the dooryard and past the sheds, down to the Penfold and the field beyond. I held his arm, feeling it tense and stiff under my fingers. I had no notion how to begin, what to say.
Perhaps I should simply keep quiet, I thought.
Both of us were still upset, though we had done our best to be calm for Brianna. I could feel the rage boiling just under his skin. Very understandable. But anger is as volatile as kerosene, bottled under pressure, with no target on which to unleash it. An unwary word of mine might be enough to trigger an explosion. And if he exploded at me, I might either cry or go for his throat. My own mood was far from certain. We walked for quite a long time, through the trees to the dead cornfield, all round the edge and back, moving all the time soft-footed through a minefield of silence. "Jamie," I said at last as we reached the edge of the field, "what have you been doing with your hands?"
"What?"
He swung toward me, startled. "Your hands." I caught one of them, held it between my own. "You didn't do that kind of damage stacking chimney stones."
"Ah."
He stood still, letting me touch the swollen knuckles of his hand.
"Brianna," he said, she didn't tell you anything about the man. Did she tell you his name?"
I hesitated and was lost.
He knew me very well. "She did tell you, no."
His voice was thick with danger. "She made me promise not to tell you," I blurted. "I told her you'd know I was keeping something from you, but, Jamie, I did promise.
Don't make me tell you, please. He snorted again, in half-amused disgust.
Aye, I ken you well, Sassenach. You couldn't keep a secret from anyone who knows you in the slightest. Even we Ian can read you like a book.
He flapped a hand in dismissal.
Then it troubled your conscience. Let her tell me herself when she will. I can wait.
His bruised hand curled slowly against his kilt, and a small shiver ran up my back.
Your hands?
I said again. He took a deep breath and held them out before him, backs up. He flexed them slowly.
Do you recall, Sassenach, once when we were first acquaint? Dougal deviled me to where I thought I must pound him, and yet I couldna do it then. You told me, hit something, you'll feel better.
He gave me a wry, lopsided smile.
And I hit a tree. It hurt, but you were right, no. I did feel better, at least for a bit.
Oh. I let out my breath, relieved that he didn't mean to press the matter.
Let him wait, then. I doubted that he quite realized yet that his daughter could be as stubborn as he was himself.
Did she tell you what happened?
I couldn't see his face, but the hesitation in his speech was noticeable.
I mean...
He drew in his breath with a deep hiss.
Did the man hurt her?
No, not physically. I hesitated myself, imagining that I could feel the weight of the ring in my pocket, though of course I couldn't. Brianna hadn't asked me to keep anything to myself, other than Bonnet's name. But I wouldn't tell Jamie any of the details she had told me, unless he asked. And I didn't think he would ask. It was the last thing he would want to know. He didn't ask, only muttered something under his breath in Gaelic, and walked on, head bent. The silence once broken, I found I couldn't bear it any longer. Better to explode than suffocate. I took my hand from his arm. What are you thinking?
I'm wondering if it is as terrible to be violated. If it is not, if there is not damage.
He shifted his shoulders restlessly, half shrugging as though his coat were too tight. I knew very well what was in his mind. Wentworth Prison, and the faint scars that webbed his back, a net of dreadful memory. Bad enough, I suppose, I said. Though I expect you're right. It would be easier to stand if there were no physical reminder of it. But then, there is a physical reminder of it, I felt obliged to add. And a bloody noticeable one, come to that. His left hand curled at his side, clenching involuntarily.
Aye, that's so, he muttered.
He glanced uncertainly at me, the half-moon's light gilding the planes of his face.
But still, he didna hurt her, that's something. If he had, killing would be too good for him.
He finished abruptly. There is the very minor detail that you don't precisely recover from pregnancy, I said with a marked edge to my voice. If he'd broken her bones or shed her blood, she'd heal. As it is, she isn't ever going to forget it, you know.
I know.
I flinched slightly, and he saw it. He made a sketchy gesture of apology.
I didn't mean to shout.
I gave him back a brief nod of acknowledgement, and we walked on, side by side, but not touching.
He began,
and then broke off, glancing at me.
He grimaced, impatient with himself. I do know, he said, more quietly. You'll forgive me, Sassenach, but I ken the hell of a lot more about the matter than you do.
I wasn't arguing with you. But you haven't borne a child. You can't know what that's like. It's...
You are arguing with me, Sassenach. Don't.
He squeezed my arm hard and let it go. There was a touch of humour in his voice, but he was dead serious overall.
I'm trying to tell you what I know.
He stood still for a minute, gathering himself.
I haven't put myself in mind of Jack Randall for some good time, he said at last. I dinna want to do it now. But there it is.
He shrugged again and rubbed a hand hard down one cheek.
"There is body and there is soul, Sassenach," he said, speaking slowly, ordering his ideas with his words. "You're a physician. You'll ken the one well, but the other is more important."
I opened my mouth to say that I knew that as well as he did, if not better, but then shut it without saying anything. He didn't notice. He wasn't seeing the dark cornfield or the maple wood with its leaves gone silver with moonlight. His eyes were fixed on a small room with thick stone walls, furnished with a table and stools and a lamp and a bed.
"Randall," he said,
and his voice was meditative.
"The most of what he did to me, I could have stood it."
He spread out the fingers of his right hand. The dressing on the cracked finger shone white.
"I would have been afraid, been hurt. I would have meant to kill him for doing it. But I could have lived after and not felt his touch always on my skin, felt filthy in myself, were it not that he wasn't satisfied with my body. He wanted my soul, and he had it."
The white bandage vanished as his fist folded.
"Aye, well, you ken all that."
He turned away abruptly and began to walk. I had to scurry to catch him up.
"What I am seeing, I suppose, is, was this man a stranger to her, who only took her for a moment's pleasure? If it was only her body that he wanted, then I think she will heal."
He took a deep breath and let it out again. I saw the faint white mists around his head for a moment, the steam of his anger made visible.
"But if he knew her, was close enough to want her, and not just any woman, then perhaps it might be that he could touch her soul and do real damage."
"You don't think he did real damage?" My voice rose, despite myself.
"Whether he knew her or not, it's different, I tell you."
"No, it's not." "I know what you mean."
"You don't?"
"I do. But why?"
"Because it is not your body that matters when I take you," he said. "And you ken that well enough, Sassenach."
He turned and kissed me fiercely, taking me completely by surprise. He crushed my lips against my teeth, then took my whole mouth with his, half-biting, demanding. I knew what he wanted of me. The same thing I wanted so desperately of him. Reassurance. But neither of us had it to give tonight. His fingers dug into my shoulders, slid upward and grasped my neck. The hairs rose up on my arms as he pressed me to him. And then he stopped.
"I can't," he said.
He squeezed my neck hard and then let go. His breath came raggedly.
"I can't."
He stepped back and turned away from me, groping for the fence rail before him as though blind. He grasped the wood hard with both hands and stood there. Eyes closed. I was shaking, my legs gone watery. I wrapped my arms around myself under my cloak and sat down at his feet. And waited, my heart beating painfully loud in my ears. The night wind moved through the trees on the ridge, murmuring through the pines. Somewhere, far away in the dark hills, a panther screamed, sounding like a woman.
"It's not that I dinna want you," he said at last,
and I caught the faint rustle of his coat as he turned toward me. He stood for a moment, head bowed, his bound hair gleaming in the moonlight, face hidden by the darkness with the moon behind him. At last he leaned down and took my hand in his bruised one, lifting me to my feet.
"I want you maybe more than I ever have," he said quietly, "and Christ, I do need you, Claire. But I cannot bear even to think of myself as a man just now. I cannot touch you and think of what he... I can't."
I touched his arm. "I do understand," I said, and did. I was glad that he hadn't asked for the details. I wished I didn't know them. How would it be to make love with him? Envisioning all the time an act identical in its motions, but utterly different in its essence. I understand, Jamie, I said again. He opened his eyes and looked at me.
Aye, you do, don't you?
And that's what I mean. He took my arm and drew me close to him.
You could tear me limb from limb, Claire, without touching me, he whispered, for you know me.
His fingers touched the side of my face.
They were cold and stiff. And I could do the same to you.
You could, I said, feeling a little faint. But I really wish you wouldn't. He smiled a little at that, bent and kissed me very gently. We stood together, barely touching save our lips, breathing each other's breath. Yes, we said silently to each other. Yes, I am still here. It wasn't rescue, but at least a tiny lifeline stretched across the gulf that lay between us. I did know what he meant, about the difference between damage to body or soul. What I couldn't explain to him was the link between the two that centred in the womb. At last, I stepped back, looking up at him. Bree's a very strong person, I said quietly. Like you.
Like me?
He gave a small snort.
God help her, then.
He sighed, then turned and began to walk slowly along the line of the fence. I followed, hurrying a little to catch up.
This man, this Roger she speaks of, will he stand by her? He asked abruptly.
I took a deep breath and let it out slowly, not knowing how to answer. I'd known Roger only a few months. I liked him, was very fond of him, in fact. From everything I knew of him, he was a thoroughly decent, honourable young man. But how could I even pretend to know what he might think, do, or feel upon finding that Brianna had been raped? Even worse, that she might well carry the rapist's child. The best of men might not be able to deal with such a situation. In my years as a doctor, I had seen even well-established marriages shatter under the strain of smaller things. And those that didn't shatter, but were crippled by mistrust. Involuntarily, I pressed a hand against my leg, feeling the tiny hardness of the gold circle in my pocket. From F to C, with love. Always. Would you do it? I said at last. If it were me. He glanced at me sharply and opened his mouth as though to speak. Then he closed it and looked at me, searching my face, his brows knotted with troubled thought.
I meant to say, aye, of course, he said slowly at last. But I did promise you honesty once, did I not?
You did, I said, and felt my heart sink beneath its guilty burden. How could I force him to honesty when I couldn't give it him back? And yet he had asked. He struck the fence post a light blow with his fist.
Ephraim, yes, damn it, I would. You would be mine, even if the child was not. And if you... Yes, I would, he repeated firmly. I should take you and the child with you, and damn the whole world.
And never think about it afterward, I asked. Never let it come into your mind when you came to my bed. Never see the father when you looked at the child. Never throw it back at me, or let it make a difference between us. He opened his mouth to reply, but closed it without speaking. Then I saw a change come over his features, a sudden shock of sick realization.
Oh, Christ, he said. Frank, not me. It's Frank, you mean?
I nodded, and he gripped my shoulders.
"'What did he do to you?' he demanded. "'What? Tell me, Claire.'
"'He stood by me,' I said, sounding choked even to my own ears. "'I tried to make him go, but he wouldn't. "'And when the baby... when Brianna came, he loved her, Jamie. "'He wasn't sure. He didn't think he could, neither did I. "'But he truly did. "'I'm sorry,' I added. "'He took a deep breath.' "'And let go of my shoulders.
"'Don't be sorry for that, Sassenach,' he said gruffly. "'Never.'
"'He rubbed a hand across his face and I could hear the faint rasp of his evening stubble.
"What about you, Sassenach?" he said. "What you said when he came to your bed. Did he think?"
He broke off abruptly, leaving all the questions hanging in the air between us, unstated but asked nonetheless. "It might have been me. My fault, I mean," I said at last into the silence. "I couldn't forget, you see. If I could, it might have been different." I should have stopped there, but I couldn't. The words that had been dammed up all evening rushed out in a flood. "It might have been easier, better for him, if it had been rape. That's what they told him, you know, the doctors, that I'd been raped and abused and was having delusions. That's what everyone believed, but I kept saying to him, no, it wasn't that way. I insisted on telling him the truth. And after a time, he believed me, at least halfway. And that was the trouble. Not that I'd had another man's child, but that I'd loved you. And I wouldn't stop. I couldn't," I added in a softer tone. He was better than me, Frank was. He could put the past away, at least for Bree's sake. But for me? The words caught in my throat, and I stopped. He turned then and looked at me for a long time, his face quite expressionless, eyes hidden by the shadows of his brows.
"And so you lived 20 years with a man who couldna forgive you for what was never your fault? I did that to you, no," he said. "I'm sorry too, Sassenach."
A small breath escaped me, not quite a sob.
"You said you could tear me limb from limb without touching me," I said. "You were right, damn you." "I am sorry," he whispered again.
But this time he reached for me and held me tight against him. "But I loved you."
"Don't be sorry for that," I said, my voice half muffled in his shirt. "Not ever."
He didn't answer, but bent his head and pressed his cheek against my hair. It was quiet. I could hear his heart beating, over and under the wind in the trees. My skin was cold. The tears on my cheeks chilled instantly. At last, I let my arms drop from around him and stepped back. "We better go back to the house," I said, trying for a normal tone. "It's getting awfully late."
I suppose so."
He offered me his arm, and I took it. We passed in an easier silence down the path to the edge of the gorge above the stream. It was cold enough that tiny ice crystals glinted among the rocks where the starlight struck them, but the creek was far from frozen. Its gurgle and rush filled the air, and kept us from being too quiet.
"Aye, well," he said, as we turned up the path past the pigsty. "I hope Roger Wakefield is a better man than the two of us, Frank and I."
He glanced at me.
"Mind you, if he's not, I shall beat him to a pudding."
Despite myself, I laughed. "That will be a great help to the situation, I'm sure." He snorted briefly and walked on. At the bottom of the hill, we turned without speaking and came back in the direction of the house. Just short of the path that led to the door, I stopped him. "Jimmy," I said hesitantly, "do you believe I love you?" He turned his head and looked down at me for a long moment before replying. The moon shone on his face, picking out his features as though they'd been chiselled in marble.
"Well, if you don't, Sassenach," he said at last, "you've picked a very poor time to tell me so."
I let out my breath in the ghost of a laugh. "No, it's not that," I assured him. "But..." My throat tightened, and I swallowed hastily, needing to get the words out. I don't say it often. Perhaps it's only that I wasn't raised to say such things. I lived with my uncle, and he was affectionate, but not... Well, I didn't know how married people... He put his hand lightly over my mouth, a faint smile touching his lips. After a moment, he took it away. I took a deep breath, steadying my voice. "Look, what I mean to say is, if I don't say it, how do you know I love you?" He stood still, looking at me, then nodded in acknowledgement.
"I know because you're here, Sassenach,"
he said quietly.
"And that's what you mean, I. That he came after her, this Roger. And so perhaps he will love her enough.
It's not a thing you do just for friendship's sake." He nodded again, but I hesitated, wanting to tell him more, to impress him with the significance of it. "I haven't told you a great deal about it, because, well, there aren't words for it. But one thing about it I could tell you."
"Jamie," I shivered involuntarily and not from the cold.
"Not everyone who goes through the stones comes out again." His look sharpened.
"How do you get that, Sassenach?"
I could hear them. Screaming. I was shaking outright by this time from a mixture of cold and memory, and he caught my hands between his own and drew me close. The autumn wind rattled the branches of the willows by the stream, a sound like dry, bare bones. He held me until the shivering stopped, then let me go.
"It's cold, Sassenach. Come inside."
He turned toward the house, but I lay my hand on his shoulder to stop him again. "Jamie?"
"Aye."
"Should I... would you... do you need me to say it?" He turned around and looked down at me. With the light behind him, he was haloed in moonlight, but his features were once more dark.
"I dinna need it, no."
His voice was soft.
"But I wouldna mind if you wanted to say it.
Now and again.
Not too often, mind. I wouldna want to lose the novelty of it."
I could hear the smile in his voice and couldn't help smiling in return, whether he could see it or not. "Once in a while wouldn't hurt, though."
"No."
I stepped close to him and put my hands on his shoulders. "I love you." He looked down at me for a long moment.
"I'm glad of it, Claire,"
he said quietly, and touched my face.
"Very glad. Come to bed now. I'll warm you."
Chapter 48. Away in a Manger. The tiny stable was in a shallow cave under a rocky overhang, walled in along the front with a stockade of unpeeled cedar logs, sunk 2 feet deep in packed earth, stout enough to deter the most resolute bear. Light spilled out through the open upper half of the stable door, and ruddy, light-filled smoke shimmered up the face of the cliff above, rippling like bright water over the stone. "Why a double door?" she had asked. It seemed excessive labour, an unnecessary refinement for such a crude structure.
"You must give the beasts a place to look out,"
her father had explained, showing her where to smooth the leather strap hinges tight around the curve of the wood. He picked up the hammer to tack down the leather and smiled at her, kneeling over the half-made gate.
"Keeps them happy, aye?"
She didn't know if the animals were happy in the stable, but she was. Cool and shadowy, smelling pungently of cut straw and the droppings of grass-fed animals. It was a peaceful refuge during the day, when its inhabitants were out grazing in the meadow. In bad weather or at night, the little stockade was a pocket of cosiness. Once she had passed near enough after dark to see the soft, misty exhalations of the animals drifting through the gap between wood and rock, as though the earth itself were breathing through pursed lips, warmly asleep in the autumn cold. It was cold tonight, the stars sharp as needlepoints in the hard, clear air. It was only 5 minutes' walk from the house, but Brianna was shivering under her cloak by the time she reached the stable. The light spilling out came not only from a hanging lantern she saw, but also from a small makeshift brazier in the corner, providing heat and light for the vigil within. Her father lay curled up on a bed of straw, his plaid drawn over him, within arm's reach of the small brindled cow. The heifer lay on her chest, feet tucked to the side, grunting now and then, a look of mild concentration on her broad white face. His head lifted abruptly at the sound of her step on the gravel, and his hand went by reflex to his belt under his plaid. "It's me," she said, and saw him relax as she came into the light. He swung his feet to the side and sat up, rubbing a hand over his face as she came in, carefully latching the lower gate behind her.
"Your mother's not back yet."
She was clearly alone, but he glanced briefly over her shoulder, as though hoping to see Claire materialize out of the darkness. Brianna shook her head. Claire had gone with Lizzie as escort to attend a birth at one of the farms at the far side of the cove. If the child hadn't arrived before sunset, they would stay the night at the Lachlans.
"No. She said if she wasn't back, I was to bring you up some supper, though."
She knelt and began to unpack the small basket she had brought, laying out small loaves of bread stuffed with cheese and tomato pickle, a dried apple tart, and two stone bottles, one of hot vegetable broth, the other of cider.
"That's kind, lassie."
He smiled at her and picked up one of the bottles.
"Will you have eaten yet yourself?"
"Oh, yes," she assured him. "Plenty."
She had eaten, but couldn't resist a quick look of longing at the fresh rolls. The early, faint sense of malaise had left her, replaced by an appetite mildly alarming in its intensity. He saw her glance, and with a smile drew his dirk and sliced one of the rolls in half, handing her the bigger piece. They munched companionably for a few moments, sitting side by side on the straw, the silence broken only by soft snuffles and grunts from the stable's other inhabitants. The far end of the stable was fenced off to provide a pen for the gigantic sow and her new brood of piglets. Brianna could just make them out in the gloom, a row of plump bodies packed in the straw, prophetically sausage-shaped. The rest of the small space was divided into three rough stalls. One belonged to the red cow, Magdalene, who lay in the straw peacefully chewing her cud, her month-old calf curled in sleep against her massive chest. The second stall was empty, filled with fresh straw, ready for the brindled cow and her tardy calf. The third stall held Ian's mare, sides glossy and bulging with the weight of an impending fall.
"It looks like a maternity ward in here," Brianna said, nodding toward Magdalene as she brushed crumbs off her skirt.
Jamie smiled and raised a brow, as he always did when she said something he didn't understand.
"Oh, aye?"
"That's a special part of a hospital where they put the new mothers and their babies," she explained. "Mama would take me to work with her sometimes, and let me go look at the nursery while she did her rounds."
She had a sudden memory of the smell of the hospital corridor, faintly acrid with the scent of disinfectant and floor polish, the babies lying bundled, plump as piglets in their bassinets, their blankets coated pink and blue. She always spent a long time going up and down the row, trying to pick which one she would take home with her, if she could keep one. Pink or blue? For the first time she wondered what the one she would now keep might wear. The thought of it as male or female was strangely upsetting, and she pushed the thought away with words.
"They put the babies all behind a glass wall so you could look at them but not breathe germs on them," she said,
with a glance at Magdalene, contentedly oblivious to the strings of green saliva that dripped from her placidly moving jaws onto the head of her calf.
"Germs," he said thoughtfully. "Aye, I've heard about germs. Dangerous wee beasties, as I know it."
"They can be."
She had a vivid memory of her mother checking her box of medical supplies for the visit to the Lachlans, carefully refilling the large glass bottle of distilled alcohol from the barrel in the pantry. And a more distant but equally vivid memory of her mother explaining the past to Roger Wakefield. "Childbirth was the most dangerous thing a woman could do," Claire had said, frowning in memory of the sight she had seen. "Infection, ruptured placenta, abnormal presentation, miscarriage, hemorrhage, puerperal fever. In most places, surviving birth was roughly a 50-50 proposition." Brianna's fingers felt cold in spite of the hissing pine chunks in the brazier, and her ravenous appetite seemed suddenly to have deserted her. She set the rest of her roll down on the straw, swallowing hard, feeling as though a bite of the thick bread had wedged itself in her throat. Her father's broad hand touched her knee, warm even through the wool of her skirt.
"Your mother will not let you come to harm," he said gruffly. "She's fought the germs before. I've seen her. She did not let them have the better of me, and she will not let them trouble you either. She's a very stubborn person, aye?"
She laughed, and the choking feeling eased. "She'd say it takes one to know one."
"I expect she's right about that."
He rose and walked around the brindled heifer, squatting down and squinting at her tail. He stood up, shaking his head, and came to sit down again. He settled comfortably back and picked up the discarded part of Brianna's roll. "Is she doing all right?" Brianna bent and scooped up a twist of straw, holding it invitingly under the heifer's nose. The cow breathed heavily on her knuckles, but otherwise ignored the attention, the long-lashed brown eyes rolling restlessly to and fro. Now and then the bulging, brindled sides rippled, the cow's thick winter coat rough but shining in the light of the hanging lantern. Jamie frowned slightly.
"Aye, I think she'll maybe do all right. It's her first calf, though, and she's small for it. She's no much more than a yearling herself. She shouldn't have been bred so early, but..."
He shrugged and took another bite of roll. Brianna wiped the sticky moisture from her hand with a fold of her skirt. Feeling suddenly restless, she stood up and walked over to the pig pen. The vast curve of the sow's belly rose up out of the hay like a swollen balloon, pink flesh visible beneath the soft, sparse white hair. The sow lay in stuporous dignity, breathing slow and deep, ignoring the squirms and squeaks of the hungry brood that scrabbled at her underside. One piglet was nudged too roughly by a fellow and momentarily lost his hold. There was a high-pitched shriek of protest, and a jet of milk spurted from the suddenly released nipple, hissing softly into the hay. Brianna felt a slight tingle in her own breasts. They seemed suddenly heavier than usual, resting on her folded forearms as she leaned on the fence. It wasn't a particularly aesthetic picture of motherhood, not exactly Madonna and child, but there was something vaguely reassuring about the sow's nonchalant maternal torpor, nonetheless. A sort of careless confidence, a blind trust in natural processes. Jamie had another look at the brindled cow, and came to stand beside Brianna by the pigpen.
"That's a good wee lass," he said approvingly, with a nod at the sow.
As though in reply, the sow released a long, rumbling fart and shifted a bit, stretching out in the straw with a voluptuous sigh. "Well, she does look as though she knows what she's doing," Brianna agreed, biting her lip.
"That she does. She's a wicked temper, but she's an able mother forby. This will be her fourth litter, and not one lost or a runt weaned yet."
He nodded approvingly at the sow, then glanced at the brindled heifer.
"I could hope that one does half so well."
She took a deep breath.
"What if she doesn't?"
He didn't answer at once, but stood leaning on the fence, looking down at the gently squirming litter. Then his shoulders rose slightly.
"If she canna bring forth the calf alone, and I canna pull it for her, then I shall have to slaughter her,"
he said matter-of-factly.
"If I can save the calf, I can maybe foster it on Magdalen."
Her insides clenched tight, making lumps and knots of the food she'd eaten. She'd seen the dirk at his belt, of course, but it was so much a part of his normal costume she hadn't thought to question its presence in this pastoral setting. The small round presence in her belly lay still and heavy, like a time bomb waiting. He crouched beside the brindled heifer and ran a light hand over the bulging flank. Evidently satisfied for the moment, he scratched the cow between the ears, muttering in Gaelic. "How could he murmur endearments to it," she thought, "knowing that within hours he might be slicing into its living flesh?" It seemed cold-blooded. Did a butcher whisper, "Sweet lass," to his victims? A small icy doubt dropped into her stomach, to join the other cold weights that lay there like a collection of ball-bearings. He stood up and stretched himself, groaning as his spine crackled. He shifted his shoulders, settled, blinked, and smiled at her.
"Will I walk you to the house, lassie? It'll be some time before aught happens here."
She looked up at him, hesitating, but then made up her mind. No,